You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Watching your videos, and for a long time, I love TED.com, and I saw your beard and very long hair, and you were talking about longevity, and I went, this guy's got to be on to something, man. That's the greatest beard maybe of all time. certainly in the academic world, you follow the Sikh tradition or something because
you're... Well, Charles Darwin had an amazing beard,
yes,
too.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. So first of all, thank you for your beard, sir.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's not actually quite so unusual in academia as you may think. George Church, for example, one of the pioneers of the Genome Project, has a beard that's almost as large as mine.
There you go. You're a fascinating guy. Let me just give our listeners just a little. I'm going to read from Wikipedia. I don't usually do this, but I think it's they do a good job. Aubrey de Grey is an English author, a theoretician in the field of gerontology, and the chief science officer of the SENS Research Foundation. He's editor-in-chief of the academic journal Rejuvenation Research, author of The Mitochondrial Free Radical Theory of Aging, and co-author of End Aging, which we're going to talk about, and Push as a book because it's great. And he's basically known for his view that human beings alive today can live to lifespans far in excess of any authenticated cases. You actually believe in immortality to an extent.
To an extent. Well, yeah. I really don't like the word immortality being associated with my work, I want to say, because, you know, it's been used. People know what immortality actually means. And yeah. So describing my work that way kind of trivializes it and makes it sound like science fiction, which is obviously something that I have to fight all the time.
So I know that. And I'm sorry to start that way, because let me just say, I don't want to... This interview, one of the things I noticed that when you do interviews is you get asked these questions all the time. For example, like, well, listen, if people live for till 200, what's that going to do about an aging population? And how are we going to take care of this? And what about new ideas and young people coming down the pike? The problem with all those questions is that you're assuming that it's going to happen immediately and we're going to be thrown into this situation immediately. And this is going to be a gradual technology, and the research you're doing and other people are doing, like Craig Venture and Venter. This is research that's going to take time to actualize. And human beings have a tendency to adapt over time to new technologies. We'll figure our problems out. And I think you do a great job of saying, look, yes, if we live till we're 200, for example, it's going to maybe come with problems. But what you're concerned with is solving problems, the biggest problem we have today, which is essentially that we're all going to die of diseases, usually, like Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and that is not a good way to die. It's not fun. So, you know.
You're absolutely right. That's one of the biggest blind spots that people have about this, is they forget how big the problem that we have today is. But actually, there's even more to it than that, because it's always possible to say, well, maybe we will come up with technological or other solutions to the problems that are created by solving this problem. But it's also possible to say that maybe there will come a time when we don't solve those problems. And, you know, I can't say for certain that we will, so I don't like to rely on that. What I say is that it doesn't actually matter whether we know that there will be solutions, because humanity of the future will be able to choose, if it wants to, it'll be able to choose not to use this technology and to stick with the status quo. The problem would be if we didn't develop the technology, and then we would deny humanity of the future the option whether to use it or not.
Mm. And just to give a sense of the scope of the problem, which I think is really interesting, you know, you talk about in Ending Aging the fact that 2/3 of all deaths are from aging. And that if that was any other, you know, if we were like 2/3 of people die from malaria or 2/3 of people die from some other disease, I mean, it would be, you know, we would be up in arms. But we sort of take it for granted that 2/3 of people should die of aging.
Yeah, exactly. One of the biggest confusions about this is that we don't take it for granted that people should die of the diseases of old age, the specific diseases like heart attacks or Alzheimer's or whatever. And yet we somehow think that aging is different from that. This is the misconception that people have. They think there's some real distinction between those two things, the diseases of old age and aging itself. But in fact, there's no distinction whatsoever. It's purely semantic.
One of the things that I thought was interesting also is, you know, somebody, there was an article that says the first 150-year-old man has already been born. Maybe. What I thought was interesting is that, you know, if I were to live to, if you told me I was going to live to 150, well, I'm 47 now. I thought to myself, you know, I could actually, I'd have 100 years to get really good at a musical instrument. Like I could actually master the piano. Or I don't know, there are so many things where I could just go and become a surgeon and just make a complete change in my life. I love being a comic, but I would imagine it has a shelf life. And so that kind of, you know, this kind of research really does open the door to so many different possibilities, so many, you know, that we never even thought existed.
Yes, I completely agree.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the interesting thing, too, is because so much of innovation is about cross-pollination. You know, when you have people who have had multiple careers in multiple different domains, yourself as an example, the solutions they come up with are much, much more interesting. I mean, you started off as an AI researcher.
Artificial intelligence, yeah.
That's correct, yeah.
And one of the things that I loved about that you talk about so much in the book is the fact that, you know, you approach this not as a, you know, as a scientific problem, but as much as an engineering problem. And the difference between engineering and, you know, biochemistry or whatever, which requires this sort of very mechanistic understanding.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think it's important to put it is that when you're trying to understand nature, you go about it in a very different way than when you're trying to manipulate nature. When you're understanding nature, you always want to use the most direct evidence and take incremental steps towards testing of hypotheses. But any kind of pioneering technological venture consists of essentially taking leaps of faith. And leaps of faith are pretty anathema to basic scientists. So I have a lot of problems just getting people to understand that the way I'm going about this is actually appropriate when their training is in basic science.
Well, look, that's another way of saying you're a visionary. You are, you know, you're a dreamer. You have to be. I mean, you're somebody who not only has the ambition to think that you can change something as fundamental as aging, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that mindset. Is that something that just that you kind of have always been that? Have you always been that way?
Well, kind of. I mean, I've certainly always wanted to make a difference ever since I was a kid. In fact, you mentioned the possibility of spending a long time getting really good at the piano. Actually, when I was a young kid, I realized that the main reason why I didn't want to spend time playing the piano was that I only had a certain amount of time to make a difference in the world, and all I would be able to do by doing that would be becoming another good pianist, which wouldn't really make much difference. So that's what led me into science, and eventually it's what led me into artificial intelligence research, because I realized that one of the really big problems in the world was that people have to spend so much time doing tedious, menial stuff that they'd rather not be doing, and we ought really to have machines that could do that stuff for us. Mm-hmm. And when I switched to the biology of aging, that was only really because I found out that hardly anybody was really working on this seriously. And I was astonished at that. It made no sense to me that people would be so blinkered about it. But still, I realized that it was an even more important problem than the problem of people having to do menial stuff, and therefore that I would make even more of a difference that way. I certainly, you know, when I was working in artificial intelligence, that was how I discovered and established that I was reasonably good at working on really hard problems. I made some important progress in that area. And so I wasn't intimidated by the sheer magnitude of the problem of doing anything about aging. And it also, of course, helped that I wasn't focused on a career or anything like that. You know, I was much more interested in doing my best to make a difference. And if in the end my work didn't pan out and other people were the people who made the difference, then that wouldn't be a problem for me at all.
Mm. Well, in the mechanisms that you talk about in the book and things like that, you talk a great deal about I think it's the seven ways that cells can break down and how we age, essentially. And a lot of your attention is on the actual biology of a human being. But
that's right.
If you read Ray Kurzweil's book and some of the other books that I've read, they also talk a great deal about how we are going to start meshing with machines. There's going to be biocompatible inorganic compounds that we'll be able to put in our bodies, nanobots, etc. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that part of your research as well?
It's not part of our research, no. I certainly regard it as an important area of research. And of course, it may turn out that I will be overtaken by such stuff, that in fact the best way to achieve the elimination of age-related ill health will end up being the adoption of, let's call it, non-biological solutions to these medical problems. However, at the moment, I think the betting is still on the straightforward biomedical approach, getting to that kind of point first. I believe that in the longer term, we will see more and more non-biological solutions, especially as such things become more and more miniaturized. And eventually, we may very well reach a point where those kinds of solutions dominate. But I think that that's going to be in the longer, in the more distant future.
Well, that's interesting to me, because I would have thought the opposite. You know, the human body, I'm sure you look at it as this very complex machine. The more we understand about how it actually works, especially how it degenerates, I would imagine that the better chance we have of stopping that process.
Well, the thing is that what we have with the human body is something, essentially, we are working on the same side as evolution. Evolution has created an enormous number of genetic tricks that make us age as slowly as we do, that help us to essentially automatically repair damage as the damage is being created as a side effect of the body's normal operation. And because of that, there's only a little bit extra that we have to add to that to clean up the little bits of damage that evolution hasn't taken the trouble to invent machinery to repair on its own. So that's kind of why, that's kind of one reason anyway, why the biomedical approach to combating aging is as feasible as it is.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by damage?
Sure. So, and this is actually something very important, because it really is the main way in which I need to demystify the whole concept of aging. People kind of, you know, you ask them what aging is, and they've all got different definitions, and they don't really understand what aging is. But it is simply the accumulation of the damage that the body does to itself as a side effect of its normal operation. And if you look at the composition and the structure of the body, obviously we're made of cells and stuff between cells, and cells are made of stuff that we know all about. So it's pretty easy to actually enumerate the kinds of things that go wrong. Some of them are at the cellular level, simply, for example, cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. And of course, that means that the total number of cells in the affected tissue will go down over time, and eventually there won't be enough cells to do the job that the tissue is there to do. And there are various aspects of aging that are driven by that type of damage. The best example is probably Parkinson's disease. Then there's damage at the molecular level, things like, for example, molecular garbage, just byproducts of normal cellular function that are, for whatever reason, not broken down and not excreted, so they just accumulate in the garbage can of the cell, which is called the lysosome.
Is that oxidation? Is that free radical stuff?
Those are some of the ways in which the garbage is created. But the key distinction you need to think of here is the difference between the way in which the garbage is created, which matters, but which we don't need to understand all that well, and the actual nature of the garbage. You know, if we can understand what the garbage is, then we can figure out ways to get rid of it. And we don't really need to understand the details of how the garbage came into existence in the first place.
And just to really break down what you're saying, I thought what was super helpful in the book was your analogy of a car, right? And the normal function of a car, soot builds up in the engine, and periodically, you know, you have to go in and get it serviced and get that soot cleaned out, right?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, and the soot is part of the job doing it, the car doing its normal job. In the same way, there are these things that the body, in doing its normal job, builds up junk, this garbage that you're talking about, and we currently don't try and remove that junk. And it's what you're talking about is as simple as basically deal with the junk, and then you'll get a far longer life out of the body.
You got it. And again, as with a car, in the car you don't need to know the details of the chemistry of how that soot became created by the engine, or how the rust got created. You only need to know what these things are and how to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so keep going with your analysis of damage. This is mitochondrial.
If we could really, I thought the mitochondrial example is a really good example of normal function leading to garbage.
Sure. So that's quite an interesting case, because mitochondrial mutations are one of the types of damage that we don't actually propose to repair in the strict sense of repair. It's more a case of reinforcing the body. In other words, ensuring that even though these mutations are accumulating, they don't translate into any kind of illness. At the moment, what happens is that mitochondria accumulate mutations. The mitochondrion is this really important part of the cell that does the chemistry of breathing and, you know, combining oxygen with nutrients to extract energy from the nutrients. And it's got its own DNA. It's the only part of the cell that has its own DNA. And that DNA, when it mutates, means the mitochondria don't work. And if the cell is taken over by mitochondria that don't work, then the cell itself is essentially suffocated. It can't do its job. And cells have a way of coping with that and staying alive, sometimes anyway, but that is sometimes to the detriment of the body overall. So the approach, the reinforcement approach that we're pursuing, which is an idea that was first put forward, not by me, back in the 1980s, is to put backup copies of that mitochondrial DNA into our normal genome in the nucleus of the cell, and thereby essentially ensure that even if mutations happen in the regular mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondrion can still work because the proteins are still present that the mitochondrial DNA normally encodes. This is not easy, of course. The reason it hasn't been done so far is because there are quite a bunch of tricks that we have to do to modify that DNA so that it still works even though it's in the wrong place. Mm. But we think we're going to get there.
Wow. And not only that, I mean, just to really break down as well what you're talking about, the you know, firstly, the mitochondria is the power plant of the cell, right? It produces all the energy. But the reason why the mitochondrion has its own DNA is because we believe that essentially these were bacteria that were once independent organisms and then became a part of the cell. So they still have their own DNA inside of the mitochondria. And it's not that the body, you know, wants this DNA to be broken down and degraded. It's just that they never, in evolution, we never figured out a system to get that DNA into the nucleus. And what you can do now is to now put that DNA where it's safe inside the nucleus.
That's absolutely right. In fact,
well done, Hunter Mott.
Well, you know, I do have a degree in biochemistry, Brian.
from Harvard, not Cambridge, yeah. Aubrey.
Oh, the other Cambridge.
The other Cambridge, yeah.
Yeah, the younger cousin,
the cute Cambridge.
The way you say it with that English, yeah. in the Queen's English is fantastic. But keep going.
Yeah, of course. The interesting thing about the history of mitochondria is that originally, when they were first incorporated into cells by what's often called the endosymbiotic event, the DNA was much bigger. There were more than 1,000 proteins that were encoded, and now there are only 13. And the reason that's happened is because nearly all of those proteins were capable of, during evolution, having their genes transferred to the nucleus. So that now the cell has this very sophisticated and versatile machinery for incorporating proteins into mitochondria, even though they are encoded in the nucleus and created outside the mitochondria. And so what we have to do is simply to essentially co-opt that machinery for these additional 13 proteins. And as I say, that is harder than it sounds, but it's not impossible, we don't think.
And let's break down what some of the challenges there would be, right? Just so that we can start to understand, for the listeners, to understand how this is really just an engineering problem, right? You would have to get what would the steps be, and what would the challenges be that you'd have to figure out?
Well, okay. So first of all, we have to make sure that the DNA sequence that we put into the nucleus is the correct sequence, and that turns out to need some changes because the machinery that translates DNA into protein is slightly different in the mitochondria, and so we have to kind of, you know, negate that difference. That's really easy, though. That's something that any graduate student could do. The second thing is to tell the cell that the protein is a mitochondrial protein. And again, that's a pretty straightforward thing. It's been understood for a long time that if you put a few very specific amino acids on the beginning of any protein, then they are interpreted by the cell as a kind of zip code that says this protein should be taken to the mitochondrion. So that, again, is a very straightforward thing to do. The difficult part is that these 13 proteins have a biophysical quality called hydrophobicity, which basically means that they are very prone to fold up into a ball rather than to just flop around. And that turns out to be a big problem because the machinery that I mentioned earlier that automatically imports mitochondrial proteins into the inside of the mitochondrion when they were created outside, that machinery needs to unfold the proteins. And unfolding a protein that's very hydrophobic, that likes to be in a ball, takes a lot of energy, and the machinery just doesn't work. So the proteins get stuck in the import machinery. There are a couple of ways around that that we've been looking at. We're jumping off from work that was done in other labs. There was some very important work done in Paris about 8 or 10 years ago now, which showed how to essentially import the protein while it was still being synthesized, while it was still being constructed on the outer surface of the mitochondrion. And that kind of sidesteps the problem. And then there's another approach, which is rather than importing the protein, we actually go one step back in the chain of events and import what's called the messenger RNA, this kind of intermediate between the DNA and the protein, which doesn't have any of this hydrophobicity problem. There are other problems that come into existence if you go that route, but they are also problems that we think we can solve. So we're pursuing both of these approaches right now.
Well, what's fascinating is this is all very new to me, and I frankly kind of following it, but not really, and I think most of our listeners would be in my camp. But what's great, what I take away from it is that, you know, you're using big words and you're a scientist and, you know, and things that I'm not, you know, I just don't use these words on a daily basis. But what's encouraging is that as you speak, I'm thinking to myself, he's just talking about, like you said, engineering problems that it sounds to me you're very confident eventually are going to be solved. So you're just breaking
right.
it down. I mean, you know.
It's not just even eventually. I mean, the thing is that we can actually describe the remaining challenges, what needs to be done to get from what we can already do to where we need to be. We can describe those challenges in a lot of detail. We really have a pretty clear route from here to there. And that, of course, means that's of course, a requirement if we want to make any kind of prediction of how hard the problem really is and how soon we have a fair chance of actually getting there.
Well so you're 51, I'm 47. What are the chances that I'm going to live, provided I don't get hit by a bus? I mean, since we're in striking distance, what do you think? What are they? Are you trying to? I mean, is there a chance I could live till I'm 120? Because I want to start playing the piano.
First of all, I know you know this, but your listeners need to be reminded of this, and this is something that I always have to emphasize really strongly. We don't work on longevity at Science Research Foundation.
Okay.
We work on health.
Right.
We're interested in stopping people from getting sick when they get old. That's all we do.
That's great.
And there will probably be a very considerable longevity side effect as a result if we're successful in doing all that we want to do.
Right.
People will actually maintain the risk of death per year that they have as young adults, which is, of course, much lower than they have as older adults.
And I'm glad you emphasize that, because I wanted to say something very quickly to piggyback on that. You're right. It's not about longevity. It's about being healthy and being able to function and do the things you enjoy, whether that's holding your grandchildren, practicing an instrument, playing tennis, whatever it is. That's the point of health, isn't it?
That is. And that's the reason why health is the single biggest thing that people don't want to lose. Mm. And yet they kind of resign themselves. People have made their peace with the idea that they are going to lose their health as they get older. And I want to show that is misguided and that actually medicine has the capacity to do something about that.
And I think the thing from a biochemistry standpoint, I mean, what you know, you're saying, which I think is so important, is that when you hear about things like nanobots, you're inventing a whole new system that then has to figure out how to interact with this system that is totally alien to it, right? As opposed to what you're doing is just taking the existing machinery and using that existing machinery and letting the systems that are already in place do most of the work.
You've absolutely got it. It's the same with other things. So that's particularly clear in the example of mitochondrial mutations that we've just discussed. It's also true in many other cases. For example, the elimination of molecular garbage, we are typically incorporating new enzymes into the cell that can do things that human enzymes naturally can't do. But those new enzymes only have to do a little bit. They only have to, like, modify the garbage molecularly in a minor way, and that gets it back into the zone where human enzymes that naturally exist can actually cope with it.
You know, talking to you, I have this image of you in your lab with your secret serums and your syringes, just like Iron Man, and you're smarter than everybody else. So you are clearly doing stuff that we don't know about. And I want to know right now in 2014 at 47 years old, I want to know how what I can do with the existing technology. What can I do to keep myself healthier? I mean, I'll tell you what I do. I exercise, try to eat my greens, I stay away from sugar, and I eat a balanced diet and try to get sleep and drink lots of water. What else do I need to do?
So in terms of what you can do in the short term health-wise, the answer is you're talking to the wrong person. That's really not my area of expertise. You know, there are plenty of other people who...
I love that. Thank you for your honesty.
There are plenty of other people who work on that and who will tell you what to do.
Right.
At the end of the day, however, the fact is that nothing that your average person can do will appreciably postpone the ill health of old age. There are differences between different people, of course, but that's true whether or not. So there's plenty of ways to shorten your life. Obviously, don't smoke, don't get seriously overweight. But ultimately, you know, beyond just doing what your mother told you, we actually do not have anything that can make a significant difference. And that means that to answer your question in a different way, to answer the question, what can you do to increase your chances of making the cut, you know, of being healthy enough for long enough to be around when the therapies that we're working on come along, the only answer is, give me large amounts of money. because that will speed up the research and make the things happen sooner.
Listen, it's a worthy place to put your money, for real. I mean, you know, if you're going to give money, give it to the SENS Research Foundation.
And is that where we should donate to SENS?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great.
SENS.org, SENS.org. There's a donate button, or if you want to send us a serious amount of money, you can always ask us how to send a wire or a check.
we have your email, so.
That's awesome. I mean, the other thing that I wanted to ask, and I know that you spend a lot of time in California, you know, California is the land of vitamins, right? Like, or vitamins.
Yoga, vitamins, everything.
Like, there, I mean, you know. I mean,
there are a lot of people in earnest doing their best to try to, you know.
Live as long as possible, colonics, all of that sort of stuff. And in general, it seems like you're saying whatever the benefits are of all those different things, they're pretty damn small.
That's right. However, let's be clear, California is also the land of visionaries and such like, and that's a large part of how we ended up here. I think that's also a large part of why we've chosen to run a conference in a month or so here. I should probably mention that while I'm on the topic. On August the 21st through 23rd, if you go to sense.org, you'll find all about it. It's going to, of course, feature some of the most cutting-edge biology that's being done relevant to all of this, but it's also going to be very eclectic. It's going to have people from industry, it's going to have policy people, regulatory people, obviously lots of people from the general public, so we're going to make sure that it's an extremely pioneering, groundbreaking meeting for pretty much everybody who has an interest in not getting sick when they get old.
The other thing that I think is really interesting, too, is that it's very clear already that probably the largest political action group in the country is the AARP, and it's only going to get more and more and more powerful. So the good news is I think you guys are going to get lots and lots of money coming down the pike because, you know.
Well, I would hope so. But, of course, the problem is that in order for people like the AARP to really get on the bandwagon and start promoting this and getting us to be sped up by having greater resources, they have to actually believe that it's what people want, and they have to believe that it's possible. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, unfortunately, still a vast majority of people are in this kind of, you know, psychological trance kind of state where, as I mentioned earlier, they've kind of made their peace with aging and they really don't want to think about it anymore.
That's what you call the pro-aging trance in the book.
That's right. That's right.
And could you break that down for us a little bit more? Because I think the psychology of where that comes from, you know, and then what are the knock-on effects of that, the second-order effects, are really interesting.
Sure, yeah. I mean, for me, it's pretty clear that when I talk to people about all of this, they just really don't want to think about it. They've kind of like, you know, they've got this fear of the unknown. They know that a world without aging would be extremely different. And they've also got this fear of getting their hopes up. They think that, you know, it might happen, it might not happen. And they are petrified of the idea of convincing themselves that they might actually not have to go the way that their parents did. And then things go a bit more slowly than they were hoping, and they have to suffer that decline anyway. You know, and I figure that that's a natural emotion. I'm not exactly, you know, resenting or blaming people for being this way, but still, it's an enormous challenge for us because it really, really diminishes public enthusiasm for getting this research to happen sooner.
Well, can I ask you about, there are some things that there are a lot of sort of wellness institutes, especially in California, where they will, quote unquote, reverse the aging process. Mm-hmm. When you go there, usually they take a look at your hormone panel and they'll give you testosterone therapy and things like that. So I know there are a lot of athletes and even people who walk around every day who take human growth hormone and testosterone therapy. I'm speaking mostly of men that I know. What do you think of that? It obviously has what looks like, at least in the short term, beneficial results. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they eat well, and I'm sure there. I don't know if there are other supplements you can take to kind of help you along the way with all these things, whether it's vitamin B12 or whatever it might be. Can you talk a little bit about that and what your research shows?
Yeah, so of course, as I say, this is not really what we do. We're very much interested in developing medicine that doesn't yet exist, typically regenerative medicine using stem cells or gene therapy and so on. However, I can certainly say that things like human growth hormone or other therapies that improve quality of life, I can't say that they're a bad idea. I certainly think that some people go too far in highlighting the potential risks of such things, for perhaps the increase in risk of cancer, for example, without acknowledging the gains that in health and quality of life that people also have. Mm. So I think it's important to have a sense of proportion about that. However, I also want to emphasize that just as for any other kind of lifestyle or dietary intervention or whatever, everyone's different. Different people have different responses to different things. Just to come back to what I was mentioning a moment ago about the cancer risk, if you've got a serious amount of cancer in your family, then that's probably a counterindication for taking something like human growth hormone. Whereas if you've got more degenerative conditions like, loss of muscle, at a relatively early age in your family, or especially if it's happening to you already and you don't have cancer in your family, then maybe that's the sort of person who would be more advised to take something like growth hormone. Mm. Now, these are the kinds of trade-offs that one needs to take into account. And of course, they don't really appear in books that you'll buy, because books, by definition, have to kind of appeal to the mass audience and therefore make generalizations that are not entirely true.
Well, and I think the other thing that's important to recognize is that those sorts of therapies that Brian are talking about are sort of they're very second order, and what you're dealing with is dealing with the root issues of aging, like what is happening on a cellular level, and how do you ensure that the basic machinery is there? Because if you get the basic machinery working properly, then those second order effects will disappear.
That's essentially correct, yes. Basically, I describe the whole process as aging is a side effect of being alive in the first place. You've got this massively complicated and poorly understood network of processes that keep us alive from one day to the next, which cause damage to the body that accumulates throughout life. And for a long time, it's completely harmless because the body is set up to tolerate a certain amount of damage. But eventually, it exceeds that threshold and you start to go downhill. So when we look at that definition, it's easy to see that if you can go in and periodically repair the damage, then you are solving the problem. You're restoring the structure of the body and therefore restoring its function. And you're doing so without even having to know very much about how the body created the damage in the first place, or for that matter, about how the damage eventually translates into pathologies.
Mm. Well, you wrote the book, The Mitochondrial Free Radical Theory of Aging. I remember when free radicals were all the rage, people said, well, you got to eat foods that absorb those free radicals and stuff. What was this book? I did not read The Mitochondrial Free Radical Theory of Aging. Can you talk a little bit about that? And if your research in writing that book in 1999, what have you added to that research, or has some of the things you've cut, the conclusions you arrived at in writing that book, been proven wrong subsequently?
I'm very pleased to say that pretty much everything in that book still has stood the test of time. Mm. It was a book that I wrote essentially for my PhD thesis, and it was very technical. It was definitely not like Ending Aging intended for a general audience. It probably had a print run of about 300. But the essence of it was just talking about how mitochondrial mutations occur, how they accumulate, how that accumulation has effects on the body that are surprisingly large for the amount of mutations that do accumulate, which is pretty low, and also a bit about how I thought we might fix it. Now, the particular approaches that we're taking now that I mentioned earlier to move mitochondrial proteins or to to essentially obviate the problem of mitochondrial mutations is something that has benefited from advances that were made since I wrote that book. But the essential idea of putting substitute genes in the nucleus was in the book, and you know, pretty much everything I said there is still true.
There are foods, aren't there, that are that I guess technically would absorb those free radicals. That's not something you really worry about. That's you're just not dealing with that. You're dealing on a much deeper level here.
So, yeah, let me talk about that a little bit, because this is a really important thing to understand. And actually, the example of free radicals is a good one. Free radicals are not just a bad thing. The thing is that, you know, breathing was invented a very long time ago when the mitochondrion came into existence about 2 billion years ago, and evolution has had to make the best of a bad job ever since. The fact is free radicals are going to be created as a side effect of the process of extracting energy from nutrients using oxygen. And the free radicals that are created can be mopped up to a large extent, but not completely. And so what has happened over the years is that evolution has found ways to make use of these free radicals as signaling molecules. And if we were now able to simply wave a magic wand and eliminate all free radicals from the body, then it wouldn't be good for us at all, I can tell you that. So that's why it makes sense not to interfere with the optimum, the happy medium that evolution has gravitated to in terms of how reactive molecules like free radicals are actually processed, but rather to dive in one step further down the chain of events, look at the relatively slow accumulation of bad things that free radicals do and eliminate that, eliminate the damage that they do, rather than trying to improve the elimination of the free radicals themselves.
Wow. Are you optimistic, and I'm sure you are, but are you optimistic that your life's work is going to something you're going to be able to realize and see in completion, or do you feel that you're going to be somebody that future scientists talk about? You are the shoulders they are standing on as they finally actualize the things that you're here for.
Well, of course, nobody can know. You know, any technology that's more than a couple of years away, you can't know really how long it's going to be before it comes to fruition.
Yeah.
But I think that there's about a 50-50 chance that we'll get all of this working within the next 20 or 25 years, just so long as funding for the early stage research that's happening over the next 5 or 10 years is elevated considerably over what exists at the moment. If that happens, then I think, you know, 20, 25 years is pretty a good estimate. And that would mean, since these therapies are going to be mainly applicable to people who are in middle age or older, that would mean that someone like me or someone like you has maybe a 50-50 chance of making the cut. However, first of all, I want to say that it might be 100 years. I think there's at least a 10% chance that it could be 100 years, because we just don't know what other problems we're going to encounter that we haven't yet identified. But the second thing I want to say is that really that's not what gets me up in the morning. I don't do this in order to save my own life or to save the lives of my loved ones. What I do is I do this for humanitarian reasons. And what gets me up in the morning is the fact that 100,000 people every single day die of this thing called aging. And furthermore, most of them die after a long period of suffering. And that's something that I want to fix.
Wow, that's but
and
you
from
know,
a, from a public health standpoint, I think what's also really interesting is that I think that it's been estimated that Medicare, something like, you know, half of all Medicare expenses are spent on the last 6 months of a person's life, and you know, I mean, and I think that's actually reflective of essentially the anti-aging trends in all of us. We hate aging. We hate dying. We hate all of these sorts of things.
Man wants to live forever.
Man wants to, well, or at least have the best possible life. I mean, you know, a person wants to see their kids grow up. They want to see their grandkids grow up. Like, you know, that's what we want to do.
Sure.
But instead, I think the interesting thing is we're spending all of this money on the last 6 months for no benefit. And if we took some of that to figuring out how to deal with the root issues that, you know, Dr. DeGray is talking about, you would save massive amounts of money. But these are psychological biases that we have.
So give your money to sends.org. And if it's a huge check, then there are other ways to do it. But then you get you've mentioned Craig Venter and stuff. He works with and if you listen to him, he's very optimistic. You know, he's talking in 20-year increments here, and he talks about synthetic biology. And then, of course, we've already talked about Ray Kurzweil, who talks about, you know, nanotechnology and things. Are you, where does, I know you guys are in different camps, but I just feel like I'd love to, you know, it seems like you guys would also have a lot to talk about. Are you going to be incorporating synthetic biology? First of all, I don't really know what synthetic biology is. I don't know if you do either, but you know.
Nobody really knows what, yeah, synthetic biology means very different things to different people. It's a bit like aging, really. Sure. I mean, you know, it would be a very unwise man who would underestimate Craig Venter. He's an extremely capable individual, and I am absolutely delighted that he has decided to get seriously involved in this. I've known Craig a little bit for quite some time. He was actually one of the judges on this kind of challenge. Prize challenge that MIT Technology Review created back in 2006 to essentially evaluate whether the proposals I was putting forward had any kind of merit. He was useful in that regard. He certainly, along with all the other panelists, unceremoniously rejected all of the attempts to show that it didn't have merit. But at the same time, as you say, yes, he does rather different stuff than what we do. Now, of course, the big news in this regard, with regard to Craig, is that he is in a new company now. He's running a company called Human Longevity Incorporated, which is designed to do something serious about aging. The company, insofar as its goals and its approach have been described so far, is somewhat more short-termist than what we're doing. It's looking to make money fairly soon, and the way, of course, it wants to do that is by exploiting what we can do already, and that ultimately, since, of course, Craig is very much a DNA man, that ultimately comes down to identifying differences between different people and figuring out ways to exploit those differences to tweak what we have. So I don't think he's going to ever suggest that the approach that he's taking now will give the same kind of postponement of age-related ill health that we're looking at. But, of course, every step helps. I think it's extremely important that we do all these relatively easy, relatively short-term things, even if those things are giving much less benefit, because any little benefit will increase the number of people who hang around long enough to make the cut with the sort of stuff that we're working on.
Well, and that's the great thing, too, is that we don't know, but there are so many good people working on it. They're attacking the problem from different ways. You know, all of those solutions may ultimately synthesize together to create something that's even greater than the sum of its parts. And I think one of the points that you really make in the book, which is so excellent, is that all too often there are researchers in a lab narrowly looking at one particular area of research, and we need more figures, I think, like you, who are willing to step back and take the broad view of what all the research is saying and how they can combine and work together.
Well, certainly that's the way we look at it.
Yeah, I mean, sharing, I've heard that there has been an exponential growth in, you know, what we're our understanding in science, mainly because you've got scientists in India sharing Skyping with scientists in Finland. I mean, a huge part of it is there may very well be a great deal of information out there, but how is it synthesized? How is it shared? Who is talking to who? What do we already know? And really, where can we place most of our energy?
The paradigm shifts don't come when you have, you know, more and more and more collections of, you know, weird birds and weird insects and all that sort of stuff. The paradigm shift happens when one man sits down, figures out, oh, what's the grand pattern of all this life? It's evolution.
Dr. Aubrey de Grey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
your name sounds like it belongs in a science fiction novel anyway. I mean, if you're going to be a scientist, you may as well have a name like
that.
Well,
I think that's the thing. It belongs in a history of science novel from the future.
Instead of Brian Callen or, you know, Hunter Motz is not bad, but Aubrey de Grey is good because you're an Englishman, but I think you have some French ancestry.
Well, I'm actually not sure whether I do, but if so, it's probably from the Norman Conquest.
Indeed. There it is.
Yeah, the time scale is just so different from America. It's so funny. You know, I went to school in England, and they always used to say, oh, our school was founded before your country was discovered. And I was like, it's true.
Well, that's why you say vitamins and I say vitamins. It's so annoying. Doctor, I really, you know, I can't thank you enough. I'm sure you're busy, and we don't want to keep you too long because you're busy dealing with a bigger problem, which is aging and keeping human beings alive a lot longer. So I feel guilty taking this much time from you, but we really appreciate you coming on, man, and talking about
it. Well, absolutely. I mean, I certainly appreciate you having me. I think that the more we can get the word out, especially via enthusiastic supporters such as yourselves, the sooner we will actually get this to happen.
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted to pair you up with somebody really famous. I was trying to get Cameron Diaz on, who wrote this book, and you know, just because it'd be fun to get, if you get some big Hollywood personality on, it just brings, I think people like you are the superstars. I think that people who, you know, we try to get people, the leaders of thought on this podcast, and I just consider it an honor because I think you guys are the ones that we should be paying attention to. We should be reading about what Aubrey de Grey is wearing today and how and whether his hair is in a ponytail or just flowing in the wind on his bicycle. I mean, these are the things I think as a culture we should be focusing on, not on, you know, Kim Kardashian's newest dress. But, you know, so it goes. Maybe I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, I'm perfectly happy for people to focus on Cameron Diaz's fashion sense if they focus on my science. But yeah, I met Cameron Diaz at TED actually several years ago, but only briefly, and it would be great to share a show with her. So maybe you can make that happen.
I'll do whatever I can, sir.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's the thing is that I think a large part of what you're saying is that the real barriers here are psychological. If we can get people past the idea that aging is something that has to happen, that it's natural, then we can really give you guys the resources you need to do the research.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as you were sitting here talking about, you know, the mechanisms by which mitochondria breaks down and stuff, I had to fight my own sort of, like, I don't know about this. This is science. I don't know anything. I'm a comic. And then I, you know, but as I really started to listen to you, it does. It just, you're breaking it down. I'm sure it's way more complicated.
It's not. But, I'll take you out. We'll get a napkin and I'll teach you all about, you know, the central dogma of translation, transcription, the whole thing.
There it is. Hunter Moss, you know, teaching me with a napkin. God, you're like a Zen Buddhist. Dr. Aubrey de Grey, thank you very much. The book is Ending Aging, and I recommend it. And listen to his lectures on TED, etc. You can
and
find
most importantly, after all of that stuff, give money.
Yeah, give money. If that sounds like an amazing place to give money.
Is Sensa 501c3?
It certainly is, yeah.
It's tax deductible.
And in fact, I don't know how many international listeners you have, but we have a subsidiary in the UK via which it's possible to give us money tax efficiently wherever you are in Europe, Western Europe.
There it is.
So take money from the tax man and give it to a longer, healthier life,
healthier life. SENS.org, Ending Aging. Aubrey de Grey, thank you so much for joining our podcast here.
Well, thank you very much again, and I look forward to next time.
Yes, sir.
Take care.
With Cameron. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Love it. I've been a fan, man. I've watched a lot of his lectures, so it was really cool to actually talk to him about this stuff. And to clear up the idea that he's not really about, it's not about living till 120. It's about not dying of a shitty disease.
Right.
You know, and it just makes you optimistic to think about the future.
Being energetic and being productive. And I think that's the thing from a societal standpoint, that's so important.
Yeah.
We have a huge, huge aging population. It's going to get bigger and bigger. For countries like Japan, that's a major crisis. And if you can extend people's productive years, then, you know, you are going to create a much, much better world for individuals and for society.
Yeah, and he did this interesting interview, and people were asking him questions, and the nature of the question, they're all some very smart people. It was this conference, and they were asking the questions were very interesting because all of them were saying, well, yeah, if you let people live for 150 years, it's going to cause all these problems. And it was very interesting. There was a great deal of resistance to this guy who's a visionary and ambitious enough to think, I'm gonna figure out a way for us to not die of shitty diseases, et cetera, et cetera. But the questions were all, wait, dying essentially is a good thing, and you're going to screw up with the way things have been. It's how we are as human beings.
Yeah,
dying happens for a reason. And yes, they were right. But he said, look, let's go back to the first thing, which is we have a problem.
Right.
People die really in a bad way. But people die in a shitty way.
This again comes back to Jonathan Haidt, which I think is so important for so many areas of life. People have moral intuitions. They feel that certain things are true. And then they desperately search for reasons to justify those feelings. Mm. We feel we've convinced ourselves, and I think that's what Dr. de Grey is saying, we've convinced ourselves that aging has to happen. It's natural and all that sort of stuff. And then we try and search desperately for reasons. And yeah. like the reason of, oh, if we had a huge population, blah, 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 it would be a huge problem, whatever. We're going to have a huge population. It's just whether that population is old and, you know, a massive drain on our society, or old and still productive and yeah. still contributing and all of that sort of stuff. And when you put it down like that, you realize that your moral intuition that aging is something that has to happen is wrong.
Right.
And that's, I think that's the thing, you know, what we have to change is, you know, the famous thing about Roger Bannister, right?
Yeah.
Nobody thought they could break the 4-minute mile.
It was considered physiologically impossible. Yeah.
And then Roger Bannister breaks the 4-minute mile, and within a year, something like 19 people, whatever it is, right? Yeah. And that's the thing.
I've still not done it.
Brian, that's yeah. because you're working on the 3-minute mile. You just want to do, like, go straight. To the...
Yeah, and also I usually have somebody on my back.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, it's just good true. For the quads.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, by the way, go to my Instagram if you want to see the kind of fast twitch muscle in my 47-year-old legs. You might want to take a look at
Brian,
how high
how do
I'm
you
jumping.
Do that? How do you do that, Brian?
Well,
what supplements are you on?
I'm taking a lot of testosterone. No, I'm not, but I'd like to. I'd like to. I'm still afraid of it. I'm waiting. I think at 55, I'm seriously going to, you're going to be like, Brian, why are you getting so muscular? Because I swear to God, I'm going to roll the dice and I'm going to get myself my second hair transplant. I mean, my first hair transplant, and I'm going to get myself on some testosterone. Come on. Did I say that out loud? We have to edit that out. That's outrageous. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've had it with you. Thank you very much. Another episode of, you know what it is.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.